here's cycle number 5, which is the cycle that we needed to be in. And we can see that the first day of Tishri for that year would be a Saturday. And it would be 355 days long. And so this is where we have to start our calendar. We'd have a Saturday, a Thursday, and a Monday, continuing on as we go down to get to 2559. Down here is where we want to be. We can now start our calendar. We can take a look at our calendar. And 2547, it had a 6-day carryover. The first Sabbath would be here. We said it had to have a 12-day lag, and here we see that it has a 12-day lag. Once we get into the first month, we have the Sabbath on the 1st, the 8th, and the 15th. Here the first Sabbath is on the 3rd, and we have our 12 days that we're looking for. Now, this year is a 355-day year, which I pointed out, and 365, so we get 10 days, and 10 days from 12 days leaves a 2-day leftover at the end of the year. If we follow these Sabbaths, carry on right straight through, there's no variation. We get to the first Sabbath of the following year. It's on the 7th, and the first Sabbath of the Hebrew calculated year is on the 5th. So we have our 2 days that we needed. And so remember, we said that the first of Tishri should be on a Saturday, the first one, and sure enough, it is. Here it is, on the 1st. 2558, if we look at 2558, the next year, we see that we have 354 days. The first day of the 7th month is a Thursday. And that's exactly what we have. Here is the 7th month. The 3rd day is a Sabbath, so the 1st would be a Thursday. The difference is 11 days. 10 from 11 leaves 1 day, so we should have a 1-day difference at the end of the month. And this is exactly what we have, carrying out the Sabbaths. 365th day, the first Sabbath is on the 7th. The first Sabbath of the Hebrew calculated calendar is on the 8th. So we can see that we have started the calendar out according to chart 3, which is the solar calendar, and the Hebrew calculated calendar from chart 6. And this is what we're getting. Now, what I've done is I've skipped forward in order to be able to show the year of the Passover, Joshua 5. And I skipped those intervening calendars because it's just, you can check on them yourself if you want in the written work that is accompanying the CD. Now, what we have here is this year is 355 days long. Well, let's go back to C.H. Lindo calendar. And here we come down, and this is the year. This would be the 40th year. We established that, 2559. And this time we should find the first of Tishri on a Monday. And the length of year is 355 days. So we can go to this calendar of 2559. We started out the calendar with a 1-day difference. And 355 days versus 365 is 10 days. So we add that to the 1, and you end up with 11-day difference. This is what we should find at the end of the year. And this is exactly what we find is 11-day difference, 6 versus 17. And so if we look at this, remember we said the Passover for Joshua 5 would be in the first month on the 14th. Well, as it works out, the 14th is a Sabbath. How can we correlate that with the description that we find in Joshua 5 for the Passover? This is the question. And the fact that it turned out here caused me to rethink what I knew about Joshua 5 and what was written in the book of Joshua depicting that Passover. So let's take a look at here. Joshua 5, 10 through 12, to be read with the following understanding. Verse 10, So the children of Israel camped in Gilgal and kept the Passover on the 14th day of the month at twilight on the plains of Jericho. So this is the very first thing we have to understand. This statement puts Thursday evening as the commencement of the Passover. Verse 11, and they ate of the produce of the land on the day after the Passover, unleavened bread, and the parched grain on the very same day. So what they did is they were eating of the land. They were eating the grain of the land, and they were eating the produce of the land, unleavened bread, and parched grain on that same day. Well, was this possible? Yes, it's possible, because in Deuteronomy 2:6, God tells them, he said, you shall buy food from them with money that you may eat. So they're going to be buying, as they are traveling to the promised land, they're going to be buying food from right in that last year, that 39th year or 40th year, they're going to be buying food from the people that live in near the promised land. So as they travel through those areas, they buy food. Then the manna ceased on the day after they had eaten the produce of the land, and the children of Israel no longer had manna, but they ate the food of the land of Canaan that year. So what what happened is God stopped manna from falling. So you can see that this Passover occurred over the weekend because of the restriction that God placed on what they could gather prior to the Sabbath day, and then they would go out on the first day of the week and gather again. So as we look at this, we got to go back to Leviticus 23 to understand the directions that God gave them when they came into the land. And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to the children of Israel and say to them, when you come into the land which I give you and reap its harvest, then you shall bring a sheaf of the first fruits of your harvest to the priest. He shall wave the sheaf before the Lord to be accepted on your behalf on the day after the Sabbath. The priest shall wave it. You shall eat neither bread nor parched grain nor fresh grain until the same day that you have brought an offering to your God. It shall be a statute forever throughout your generations in all your dwellings. So here's where the problem occurs, because they have these instructions. Look, you can't eat of the grain of the land. But then when we read Joshua, it sounds like, well, they are eating the grain of the land. Well, they're not eating the grain of the promised land, they're eating grain from different areas. And we're going to see where this grain came from biblically. When, as they were moving into the promised land or coming to the promised land, God started Moses out on a military campaign. And this is what took place. Now, when the congregation saw that Aaron was dead, all the house of Israel mourned for Aaron 30 days. It's important to understand when they were traveling. And so we continue to read, and Aaron the priest went up to Mount Hor at the commandment of the Lord and died there in the 40th year after the children of Israel had come out of the land of Egypt in the first day of the fifth month. So the first day of the fifth month is when he died. And it's the fifth month. Well, this is the start of the summer season, basically. And so we have to have this time frame. We have to keep this in mind. And so God gives the land as a possession. I make this point because we're going to come to see that what the land that they conquered, what was this land? And the Lord said to me, see, I have begun to give Sion and his land over to you. Begin to possess it that you may inherit his land. So he's telling me, you're going to inherit the land. Well, what does that mean? That means it must be part of the promise. In Deuteronomy 2:31, he says, then we turned and went up the road to Bashan. And Og, king of Bashan, came out against us, he and all his people, to battle at Edrei. And the Lord said to me, do not fear him, for I have delivered him and all his people and his land into your hand. You shall do to him as you did to Sihon, the king of the Amorites, who dwelt in Heshbon. God gave this land to the Israelites as a possession. So again, we're looking at this land. Well, the question is, was, in effect, this really part of the promised land? Was Moses in the promised land? Most people think he wasn't, but in fact, you will see that he was. He said, here's Moses writing. He says, then I pleaded with the Lord at that time, saying, O Lord God, you who have begun to show your servant your greatness and your mighty hand, for what God is there in heaven or on earth who can do anything like you, like your works and your mighty deeds? I pray, let me cross over and see the good land beyond the Jordan, those pleasant mountains and Lebanon. And here's where the problem comes in, because most people think, oh, well, the promised land is on the other side of the Jordan. Well, the promised land is not on the other side of the Jordan only. And so we're going to find out about this. We're going to see that, in fact, Moses and the Israelites were in the promised land before they crossed the Jordan River. We continue to look, read, and it says, but the Lord was angry with me on your account and would not listen to me. So the Lord said to me, enough of that. Speak no more to me of this matter. Go up to the top of Pisgah and lift your eyes toward the west, the north, the south, and the east, and behold it with your eyes, for you shall not cross over the Jordan. So when you think about this, is really quite simple, isn't it? He's on a mountain. And if he looks to the north, south, east, and west, he's looking at all the land. He's on the other side of the Jordan. So he must be in the promised land. It's pretty simple. But it's also very important that we know this, because this shows that the promised land is on both sides of the Jordan. We're going to see this from your Bible. On the same day that the Lord made a covenant with Abram, saying, to your descendants I have given this land from the river Egypt to the great river Euphrates, the Canaanites, the Chazonites, and etc. And he continues on, and we get to the Raphaim and the Amorites, the Canaanites, the Gagashites, and the Jebusites. And this is, he's saying, you know, their land, this is the land I'm going to give you. Well, it's important to understand about these two nations here, the Raphaim and the Amorites. Well, where were they? And we see that this was land that God promised to Abraham and his descendants. So here we see the Raphaim's land was also east of the Jordan, Genesis 14:5. The city of Asheroth, is about 20 miles east of the Sea of Galilee. This proves that once they crossed the Arnon River, they were in the land of promise as specified as a covenant by God to Abraham. And so it's really quite simple that, you know, the Israelites, once they crossed that river, they were in the promised land. And so was Moses. Now, remember, I pointed out about the time of the year. This is an important consideration. We need to know what time of the year was it that this took place. And we look here, and now the children of Reuben and the children of Gad had a very great multitude of livestock, and they saw that the land of Jazer and the land of Gilead, that indeed this region was a place for livestock. Therefore, they said, if we have found favor in your sight, let this land be given to your servants as a possession. Do not take us over the Jordan. So these two and a half tribes come to Moses. They said, look, we would like to stay here. This is a pretty nice spot. And it fits perfectly with our cattle. We have these animals, sheep and goats and cows, etc. And it's where we'd like to stay. Now, Moses he's a little, you know, thinking a further ahead. He's thinking, you know, well, what happens when we cross the Jordan and we have these battles to fight? And you guys are sitting back here, and I need all of your fighting men up there with us. So he thinks this through, and he makes a decision about it. And what he decides is he says, look, you need to provide 40,000 fighting men and for the army. And these men will lead the attack. They're going to be in the front. And so they think it over, and they said, well, you know, that's not a bad thing. Our numbers are much greater than that. We can afford to send those 40,000 men. And so they had now this opportunity to take over this land. Well, it just had been conquered, and so they didn't have a whole lot to do. They had to repair some of the buildings and set up stockades for their animals, etc. And this is what they were going to do. Now, when did this take place? Well, if you look at Josephus, he says it took place in the summer. Well, it did take place in the summer. They had conquered the land in the summer. Well, what did this mean to the Israelites? What was necessary that they looked at that they realized they had to do in order to be able to send these 40,000 men? And they had a requirement. If you look at Joshua, you will see that Joshua did just as Moses told them to do, and the people followed Joshua. So they were doing exactly as Moses had instructed them to do. Now, there's some important instructions involved in this. Now, just as a side, we need to kind of understand about manna. Now, manna was like coriander seed, and its color was like the color of Bedlam. And the people went about and gathered it, ground it on millstones or beat it in the mortar, cooked it in pans and made cakes of it. And it taste was like the taste of pastry prepared with oil. That sounds pretty good to me. I guess I like pastry. Too bad. It puts on a lot of pounds, but, you know, got to hold back on that. So this is some information about it. Next, it says, speak to the children of Israel. Here's Leviticus 23:10. Speak to the children of Israel and say to them, when you come into the land which I give you and reap its harvest, then you shall bring a sheaf of the first fruit of the harvest to the priest. So here's the instructions that they have to do when they come into the land. And this is where the controversy comes on. They said, well, they never had an opportunity. They weren't in the land, promised land. They never had an opportunity, pardon me, for pounding on the table. They never had an opportunity to raise this sheaf, to wave. Well, is that true? And remember, we found out something interesting. We found out that they were in the promised land and that they were in the promised land at the middle of summer, and they had taken possession of the land. For even when you were with you, we commanded you that if anyone will not work, neither shall he eat. Now, this is an important little piece of information from the New Testament. And the Israelites were well aware of this. And, you know, they were hardworking people. Remember, they were slaves. And so they recognized that, you know, this freeload that we're getting from God of the manna is not going to last. It's coming to an end. God is not going to continue to pour down this manna on us, so we need to take care of this. Well, how are they going to take care of it? Well, they have to have grain then to replace the manna that they've been getting for free. You know, God is not running a freeloading system. So we take a look again in here. The manna ceased on the day after they had eaten the produce of the land, and the children of Israel no longer had manna, but they ate the food of the land of Canaan that year. Now we're going to go back to read Leviticus 23. And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to the children of Israel and say to them, when you come into the land which I give you and reap its harvest, then you shall bring a sheaf of the first fruit of your harvest to the priest. He shall wave the sheaf before the Lord to be accepted on your behalf. On the day after the Sabbath, the priest shall wave it. You shall eat neither bread nor parched grain nor fresh grain until the same day that you have brought an offering to your God. It shall be a statute forever throughout your generations in all your dwellings. So what it's saying is, now wait a minute, you cannot eat of the grain until you've made this wave sheaf offering. Now, the Israelites were well aware of it. Joshua was well aware of it. So Moses was well aware of it. So how was it going to accomplish this end goal? The basics of the sheaf of grain grown by the Israelites in the promised land. This is the next important thing that we're going to look at. Who had the responsibility for cutting the sheaf? Well, the way, you know, it's been taught, well, the high priest has his chosen men that go out after the Sabbath and before this high day, and he has them go out and cut a sheaf of grain and bring it in, and then he waves the sheaf. Well, is this what the instructions that God gave to them really should be? Or is this an invention that, you know, the Jews have come up with to make things a little easier on the high priest? Well, let's take a look at that. Speak to the children of Israel and say to them, when you, who is the you? When you come into the land which I give you and reap its harvest, you shall bring a sheaf of the first fruits of your harvest to the priest. It shall be a statute forever throughout your generations in all your dwellings. So who is the responsibility to cut the grain? Not the high priest. It's the people who raised the grain. They have that responsibility. Every one of them. Because this was, everyone was looking for a blessing for himself, for his land, and this was part of it. What did God commend the individual command? The individual had the responsibility to cut the grain, and bring the sheaf to the priest. Now, he shall wave, here's his responsibility, he shall wave the sheaf before the Lord to be accepted on your behalf on the day after the Sabbath. The priest shall wave it, and you shall offer on that day, when you wave the sheaf, a male lamb of the first year without blemish as a burnt offering to the Lord. Its grain offering you shall be 2/10 of an ephah of fine flour mixed with oil, an offering made by fire to the Lord for a sweet aroma. And its drink offering shall be wine, 1/4 of a hin. And you shall eat neither bread nor parched grain nor fresh grain until the same day that you have brought an offering to your God. It shall be a statute forever throughout your generations in all your dwellings. So here's the instructions. Every person, his responsibility, not only to cut this sheaf of grain to bring it to him, but the only restriction that he really had was that he wasn't supposed to eat of it. He could cut it. He could grind it. He had to grind it in order to have this offering for the high priest. He could do all of these things. There's only one thing that he couldn't do. That was eat of it. Now, the question is, remember, we're talking about the Israelites arriving in summertime, sometime late summer, in the promised land and taking over the land. And so the question is, well, what about how does this grain come about? Well, the problem is most ministers today do not really understand how small grains are grown and when they grow. Barley is a 5-month crop. Think about that. And barley is not planted in the spring. Take my word for it. I did some farming. Barley is not planted in the spring, it's planted in the fall. Like winter wheat is planted in the fall. Both crops are planted in the fall. No, the wheat harvest is longer. Barley comes first. And this is what God had instructed them to do. So if you understand this correctly, and there's another little piece of information that's important. The Israelites that were on the other, hadn't crossed over, the 2.5 tribes, were primarily cattlemen, you might say. Well, there's a practice that a lot of people are not aware of, a farming practice, and the only reason that I'm aware of it is because my ancestors, my grandfather, lived in Kansas and had raised cattle, and he also raised a lot of wheat. And my dad said, well, you know, this is what we did. We'd plant the wheat, and then we would turn the cattle out on the wheat after it came up. And he said, you know, why? Well, why would you do that? And he said, well, because when the cattle feed on this newly growing grain, it causes the grain to stool out. In other words, stooling out is a matter of having a lot of stems coming from a single seed. And so you would increase your harvest. So this is an old-time practice. And this is exactly what the 2.5 tribes would have done. And so the reality is, yes, they raised the grain. It was raised in plenty of time for the wave sheaf offering. And it was raised on in the promised land. So when we take that into consideration, it now clears up all of these problems that we would be looking at involving the Passover, Joshua 5. Remember, these were the directions given to all those raising the crop. It was a mini celebration allowing them to eat the new crop or the first crop of their field upon entering the promised land. Deuteronomy 16:9 is cited as a direction that prohibits the sheaf from being cut prior to the wave sheaf offering. And it reads, you shall count 7 weeks for yourself, beginning the count 7 weeks from the time you begin to put the sickle to the grain. And the word begin, Strong's number 2490, is a hipful infinitive of this verb. The dictionary definition of an infinitive is as follows. An infinitive, meaning unlimited or indefinite, applies to a certain mode or form of the verb by origin, a verbal noun, and in English, commonly preceded by the preposition to, which expresses a general sense of the verb without restriction to person or number. And so that's the reason why, when you look at that, it doesn't really apply. Now here, the English-Hebrew concordance of the Old Testament cites four places where the word is used in the infinitive. Genesis 11:6, this they began to do. You can see it's not definite. Deuteronomy 16:9, which we read, from such time as thou beginnest. From whatever time you begin, the count shall go forward. 1 Samuel 3:12, when I begin, I will make an end. 2 Chronicles 3:10, since the people began to bring. So you see, it's not a definite time, so it's something that we should not look to in that light. This makes Deuteronomy 16:9 a general instruction about the beginning of the counting for the Feast of Weeks, and in no way prevents the general cutting of the grain before the wave sheaf offering day. The emphasis is on the number of weeks to be counted, not the starting point. Christ tells us in John 10:35 that the scripture cannot be broken. With the correct understanding, these scriptures do agree. The wave sheaf was cut first, then the grain that was ripe was harvested in preparation for the wave sheaf offering, just as Leviticus 23 requires. This chapter prohibits the Israelites from eating the grain of the land until the wave sheaf offering. Joshua 5:11 tells us that they did eat of this grain, so the wave sheaf offering had to have been made. Verse 12 shows that God confirmed that all was done with his approval by stopping the manna the next day without any punishment or sign of his disapproval, not for following the implicit instructions of Leviticus 23:10-14. Not following these instructions would have been a breach so serious as to bring immediate punishment by the Eternal. They ate, and God blessed them with the conquering of Jericho. The two calendars, as brought forth from the creation, are absolute. They cannot be denied. As shown, the Passover of Joshua 5 fell on a Friday, and the first day of unleavened bread was on a Saturday. And so here we see this. Here we see that here's the calendar for 2559. We can see here's the one-day difference. So you have the Sabbath on the 1st, on the 8th, on the 15th. Here you have the Sabbath on the 7th and on the 14th. And so you can see that you have the Sabbath is on the 15th day, not the 14th day. So as far as the Hebrew calculated calendar, so the 14th day was on a Friday. And when you put the 14th day on a Friday, everything works out just right according to the description that we find in Joshua 5. And the description, of course, that we find in Joshua 5, we already went through, and we see that what they did is they had the Passover on a Friday. The first day of unleavened bread was on a Saturday. And so the wave sheaf offering would have been on a Sunday. Well, that was the first day. The Sunday is the first day of the week. And that was the day that God stopped the manna from falling. And so they had grain to eat from that time forward. We now go into the alignment of the Gregorian calendar to the solar calendar and the Hebrew calculated calendar. In order to do that, we have to look at some important information. Chart 5, page 2, cycle 7, shows the Day of Trumpets that is presently used. It begins with Thursday, October 2nd, 1997, and continues through Monday, September 14th, 2015. This is a very important section, because what it's going to do is going to show that these calendars that we've been following through these biblical accounts, in fact, carry right through to the very Sabbath day that we keep today and the very holy days that we keep today. Remember, as I pointed out, those days are fixed. They cannot be moved. And if this is really correct, neither can the days that we are presently observing. They can't be moved either if they are correct. So let's go ahead here. Here you can see 1997. And we find that Thursday, October 2nd, was the first of Tishri, or the Feast of Trumpets, and the year length of 354 days. If you follow through, you can come down. Here we are. This is the year we are presently in. And obviously, we know that September 29th, Thursday, September 29th, is the Feast of Trumpets. So here we are. We have these days. Now, if all these calendars can be correlated so that they show the same information, then we know that these days are just set. They were set, in fact, from creation. They can't be changed. Let's take a look and see what we find. There are two factors that will guide the placement of the three calendars relative to each other. One is that it must show that it is close to 6,000 years from creation, either plus or minus. Secondly, that it must be in cycle number 7, as chart 5 shows, if the dates are to be aligned. Let's go back. Here is the cycle that we're looking at. It's cycle 7. If it is true, and then we should find that these days should be aligned according to cycle 7. And this is where chart 6 is going to come in to be important. The other point is that we know that approximately 6,000 years have passed since creation. Well, how do we know that? Well, many men have done a lot of studies. And they show that, well, we're right around 6,000 years. Some say, well, we're over 6,000. Some say we haven't reached 6,000. And what did they do? They based their information on the king's historic events, the length of the reign of certain kings, etc., and they try to come up with this amount of passage of time. And it's close, but it isn't accurate. What I am going to show you is absolutely accurate to the day. You will see that when we look at this, you will see that what we are looking at is going to be an accurate calendar. Well, first thing that we have to do is we have to look at our chart 6. And we look at chart 6, and we have to be 6,000 years. And we have to be at the end of cycle 6, because remember, our E.H. Lindow's chart started on 7 for our present-day calendar. And so here we are, 6,042 years. So what this is telling us is that we're well past 6,000 years. Well, when you're looking at 6,000 years, I guess 40 or 50 years is not much. But this is what we are. And at this point, you're minus 29 days. It's lagging by 29 days. And so, okay, let's take a look at the next calendar. We go back and we said, well, maybe we're too far. And so then if we go to the sixth cycle here, in the previous set of cycles, we find that we'd be only at 5,795 years. We're a long way from 6,000 years. We're not even close. So it can't be that cycle. So therefore, it has to be this cycle. So this is the cycle. This is an absolute. We're looking at the absolute calendar. Remember that. And so we'll take and look at our absolute solar calendar, and we'll take a look and see, well, where should we be at if we're at 6,042? Well, it should be a type 1 day with a one-day carryover. So 6,043 would follow accordingly. So we know how to start the calendar, don't we? And we know what cycle we need to be in. So let's take a look at these calendars. And here, what I've done with these calendars, I've made a different calendar here. Here we see, this is the year, the AM year, 6,043. Here is the Gregorian year, 1997. And remember, that's where we were looking to. And we said, well, we had the previous year was a type 1 with a one-day carryover. Well, we put it in there. This is absolute. It's not going to change. This is where it's going to be. So now we have the first Sabbath on the 6th. If we look at this, we find that the calculated calendar would be 29 days. What we have to do is we have to look to see where this Sabbath is going to be. So you have a 6, 13, 20, 27, 34. If there's a 29-day lag, you'll have to be at least in the 30s someplace. So when we look at this, this would give us the lag, right? Well, we know that C.H. Lindow's calendar told us that the first day of Tishri would be a Thursday, didn't we? And so it would be the first Sabbath would be on the 3rd. And it said the 29th, that the first month of Nisan will have the first Sabbath on the 5th. The solar Sabbath is on the 34th day. And so when you subtract 5 from 34, you have 29 days. There is the 29-day lag that's needed. And as you can see, what I did here is I placed, here's the solar calendar in blue. Here's the Hebrew calculated calendar in red. In black, I have the Gregorian calendar. Now, the Gregorian calendar for that year, 1997, is in fact, that is the correct Gregorian calendar, placing these dates accordingly. So when we look at this here, we see that it's the 10th month. We see that October 2nd would be a Thursday, and that's exactly what it is. It's a Thursday. Now, when I first started working on this calendar, I realized that there were certain differences between the Gregorian calendar and the solar calendar. The solar calendar leap years were on alternate two-year intervals. So they didn't coincide. The leap years didn't coincide. And then the Gregorian calendar started its year in the middle of winter. And God's calendar started in the spring. And so we have all these anomalies. And you'd say, well, how could they possibly work out? How could this be? You know, when you consider all of these things that are working against these calendars, for them to work out is really mind-boggling. You couldn't really place a mathematical formula on this for the possibility. This would be a tremendous for the three calendars to be in agreement. But in fact, the three calendars are in agreement. Yeah, you see, 1997, we saw that what day it was supposed to be. We follow the calendar down here. We were 29 days, but we find that we had 365 versus 354. There's 11-day difference. So 29 from 11, what does that leave? It's 18 days. And so we have to have an 18-day difference in our calendar, and that's a 19 and a 1 over a 19, there's the 18-day difference. And so we see that that is taking place. Now, you also can see here, I show how the year ends. You see, I put, here's 1998 starts here. It starts during the Hebrew calculated calendar of 1997. And so it carries forward, and you would think, well, that's going to really create a problem. But it's not going to create a problem, because we're going to see how this works out. Now, we have the 1 over the 19, 1 over the 19, and we've carried the Gregorian calendar through exactly the way it has to be carried through. And so the Gregorian calendar continues on. This is the third month. Here's the fourth month, the fifth month, etc. And we actually need to go back to that calendar here as a reminder. We have Monday, the 21st. That's when Feast of Trumpets should happen. Well, okay. Let's take a look at our calendar and see if that happens. And so if we follow the calendar, we can see here we're following the calendar. Here we're following the calendar. It was correct here. So let's see if it's correct down here for this month. We said it should be Monday, and that's what it is, the 6th. And it should be the 20th, and that's exactly what it is on the Gregorian calendar. And so we can see here that we're in the 9th month. See, there's the 9th month. Here's the 10th month. So we have the right month, we have the right day of the month, and we have the right day of the week. So the two calendars are running exactly the way they're supposed to run. Let's see. This year, we're going to see that the 1st of Tishri is going to fall on the first, on a Sabbath. And that's exactly when it falls. Here it is on a Sabbath. Well, here we have the 9th month, and it should fall on the 11th day of the 9th month, which the 11th day of the 9th month of this year is a Sabbath. So here we're proving that the Sabbath days that we observe are in fact the same days, these Sabbath days that we observe, are in fact the same days, the same day that's a replication of 7 from the creation. This calendar is an absolute calendar. You can't move any dates. They are fixed. And what I've done is I've provided these calendars. There's one more interesting thing that's going to establish this calendar that we've been working on here. And that is the fact that the first and second temple were destroyed on exactly the same day of the month. This day of the month was in 70 AD, the second temple was destroyed, and it was destroyed on the fifth month, on the ninth day, the going out of the ninth day, which was a Sabbath day. And this is a recorded date. Now, it's historically recorded. It's not biblically recorded. So we are going to take a look at this time and set this calendar so that we can see whether the calendar, in effect, agrees with an historical date. And so we're looking here to see if this is in order for the fifth month, one of these calendars is going to show that. Well, we'll just go on right on. We have to start at 59 AD in order to be able to establish this calendar. The explanation you'll find, if you read the explanation, you will see that this explains how this calendar was set up. The small box to the left, that's this box here, has the AM year, and that is the AM year of 4105, and followed by eight letters. That's, you see, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Sabbath day, is what you have, representing the days of the week. Below the AM year is the Gregorian date of 59 AD. Well, 59 AD, where did we get that? Below that is a series of numbers taken from the chart 3 for the year 4105. So this series of numbers here are the numbers that are taken from chart 3. So it is a two-day carryover, and so we put in the rest of the days. The first Sabbath is on the 5th. And so that's what happens there. So we're just doing what I'm just writing out here, what I did on those charts, because I don't think it's necessary to show those, to re-show those charts. The red numbers are the Sabbaths for the Hebrew calculated calendar. And the blue numbers, of course, are the Sabbaths for the solar calendar. The black numbers are the Sabbaths in Gregorian days. Chart number 6, page 3, has the year ending with the difference of 21 days. The solar calendar is now 21 days advanced at the start of 4105. The year 4105 has 354 days. This is found in chart 5, page 2, cycle 9, top line. This shows that the first day of the seventh month, that Tishri, is on a Thursday, the 4th of October. The SC is 365 days long. The difference is between the SC and the Hebrew calculated calendar will be 21 days. 21 minus 11 equals 10 days at the end of the year. And this is exactly what we find at the end of the year. And so when we go, we're going into the next year, 60 AD. I didn't continue on with the explanations because it's really self-evident what they are. So what I did was I just skipped ahead to 69 AD. And you can check this out when you get the CD and see how all these calendars follow. One calendar follows the other. Now, here we have 69 AD. We're going into 70 AD. This year, the HCC is 384 days long. The SC is 365 days long. The difference is 19 days. So you have 0 minus 19 days, so you have 19 days difference at the end of the year. And this is exactly what you have, 1 over 20. It shows that 19 days. Chart 5, page 2, cycle 9, line 11, has the first of Tishri as Tuesday, the 12th of September. And if we look at this, we find, well, here's the 5th is a Sabbath, so Tuesday would be the date. And here we see we are in the 9th month. And if you take 5 days from this, you'll find that it's on the 11th. So that's the exact date that it's supposed to be on, the Gregorian day, the 9th month, 11th day, a Tuesday. And that's exactly what it is. Now, we go down into the next calendar, and this is the calendar that is quite interesting as far as I am concerned, because it shows exactly what historical information is. We're starting out this month where the Sabbath is on the 6th, the 13th, the 20th, 27th, 34th. And this year, the Hebrew calculated calendar is 355 days, 366 days, because this is a leap year. The difference is 10 days. It's 365 days. The difference is 10 days. There was a 19-day difference at the end of 4115 a.m., minus the 19 days, plus the 11 is 8 days. There should be an 8-day difference is what we should find. And if we go down here, that's exactly what we find. So this is shown by the red 3 over the blue 11 on the bottom line of the right-hand box. Chart 5, page 2, cycle 9, line 12, has the first of Tishri on Monday, the 1st of October. And so let's take a look and see if that's what we have. First of Tishri on a Monday. This is the 6th. It's on 6th. This is October. So the 1st would be a Monday. So that's exactly where it's supposed to be as far as the Gregorian calendar is concerned, 1st of October. The red line under the 30T has the black 6 over the red 6 for the first Sabbath, putting the 1st of Tishri as required. The second temple was destroyed on the 9th day of the 5th month, a Sabbath day, in the year 70 AD. So we've established that this is correct Gregorian, Hebrew calculated calendar, and solar calendar. This is a correct calendar. So if we look for the 5th month, 5th month of the Hebrew calendar, we should find this to be the case. And here is the 5th month. And what do we find? We find that here's the 9th, is a Sabbath day. The temple was destroyed on the 10th. It was the going out of the 9th of Ab. That's the 5th month. And there we see that the calendar actually shows this historical event occurring just exactly as the Jewish tradition, historical tradition, shows it to be. What does this tell you? This tells you that the Jewish authorities, what calendar were they using? Well, they were using the Hebrew calculated calendar. That was the destruction of the Second Temple. This means that every Sabbath and every holy day has been preordained from creation to the present and will continue in this fixed order until the return of Christ. The facts show, without exception, that these days are spelled out in the Hebrew calculated calendar. This is, in fact, the calendar that we should be following today. It shows that the very days that we look at, the very days of the week that we use, are in fact the same days that are a replica of 7 days from the creation. It's not disputable. You can do all you want, but you cannot change those days. Therefore, all the holy days are fixed as well as the Sabbath days. This is, in fact, a proof of the Bible. And not only the proof of the Bible, but it shows what day God has designated as his Sabbath and what days he's designated as his holy days. There is no other explanation. This is an absolute proof of God's calculated calendar. It's the calendar that God has used from day one. It was a calculated calendar so that we would know ahead of time when to show up for the observance of the Feast of Trumpets, the Day of Atonement, what day that Day of Atonement would be on, when to observe the Feast of Tabernacles. So this is the conclusion. And I thank you for spending the time following this fairly difficult presentation, but it's an absolute proof. In addition, I have provided for your giving you the opportunity to do your own study as far as the calendar is concerned. I've provided this chart, which actually covers all the days of starting with day one right here. You can see that. And it goes all the way through to the present day. And you can look up any of these days. They work out on the 19-year cycle principle. And you can see that this is how it works. In addition to that, I have provided Hebrew calendar according to C.H. Lindo, which is the calendar that we use and which is the calendar that was used throughout this presentation. Here you can see this. In addition, I've provided a series of calendars that I've gone through which cover the period of 18 BC down to 1 AD. The reason I did that is so that you wouldn't be confused over the 0 year, which some people are confused about. And then in addition to that, I provided a calendar that that covers a time period of from the 27th to the 30 AD. So this would give you an opportunity to look for the crucifixion year. This concludes the presentation. And I hope that it has been of use to all of you who have spent the time and effort to follow it.